I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hi, I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to Action Packed. On our weekly travel podcast, we interview some amazing people who ventured to the far corners of the world.
We hope you'll feel as inspired as we do by their extraordinary journeys.
So let's go straight to the action. Today we're talking face-to-face, a welcome change from Zoom, with indefatigable travel writer Minty Clint. For the past 30 years, Minty has ventured on horseback to some of the wildest corners of the world. But that's just a single facet of a truly remarkable life of action-packed adventure. Minty, welcome to our travel podcast. Increasingly, you remind me of one of those intrepid 19th century female explorers like Mary Kingsley or Lady Hester Stanhope, emerging alive and well from the empty quarter on a camel after 3 months alone in the desert. How did this urge to travel come about?
Well, as an Irish peasant, I was always contrary by nature. So in my childhood, we never travelled anywhere and we never went to the cinema. So I decided in the end, I would make careers out of doing those things, which I always wanted to do and couldn't. So my liking for adventure travel started in the classroom when I was about 10, in the geography lesson, and we had a picture of a communal hut on the banks of the Amazon. And I looked at it and I thought, one day I shall be there. And 16 years later, I was. So that got it kicked off. But it was quite a difficult journey for me. Family that didn't travel.
How did you get into journalism?
Well, when I was a teenager, people would always say, what do you want to do when you grow up? And no women in my family had ever worked, so I have very little idea of what career openings there might be. But I liked the sound of journalism and I could write nice essays, so I thought, so journalist. So it was vanity, really. It sounded good to me.
And how did you actually get into it? You worked for as a film critic, very well-known film critic in the 80s and 90s.
Well, I was more an all-purpose film hack. I worked on a lot of locations for films and I wrote unauthorised biographies of American superstars.
Like who did you write?
Like Clint Eastwood and Robert Redford. The first one was James Cagney. Obviously, I didn't meet him because he was not available to authorise it by that time. And Burt Lancaster. And Harrison Ford, right? So there were five of those. I met Harrison Ford several times and Clint Eastwood several times and Robert Redford once. And they were all very nice when they were young. I went to Hollywood when I was starting out on my first great adventure travel and I didn't really know anything about the film industry then. So I rang up Universal Studios and said, have you got anyone that I can interview? And they said, well, you can interview Clint Eastwood if you like, and at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So I borrowed my friend's car, totally terrified, turned up at the studio and was ushered to Clint's bungalow, where he was with Jean Seberg, who was his current squeeze. And she, of course, looked furious because I was younger than her, and not so beautiful. And Clint was charming, and we had a very nice chat and a beer. But later on, he got quite... They get power hungry, these people, I'm afraid. It does go to their heads. Harrison Ford as well, actually. He was very pleasant and unassuming when I first met him after the Star Wars films, when he was making Raiders of the Lost Ark. But later on, he got quite sort of grumpy when he got richer. And that's the problem. Power does corrupt.
So you went from there to as a film critic and then you branched out towards mainstream travel?
Yes, that happened. In the 90s, the film industry changed and the jobs I'd had on films where I went and hung out for 6 weeks, like I did on Killing Fields, for example, in Thailand, stopped because they started to cut the budgets, so there were no longer any, I was a sort of worked for the producers, David Putnam and people, writing notes and background material so that they could use it when they wanted to publicise the film. And that was a wonderful job because I talked to the actors all day because they never had anything else to do either while other people slaved. So that sort of thing came to an end and the publicists became much stricter about what you said about the people in the interviews. So if you interviewed Clint Eastwood and said anything bad about him, I mean anything not vicious but just slightly non-positive, he would make Warner Brothers refuse to let any of their people be interviewed. So that was very restrictive. And then some friends of mine took up free skiing as a profession, as a journalistic profession. And when I learned that you could do that, I thought I might start skiing again and do the same.
You skied as a child, had you?
No, I didn't. I skied at university. I went, and then I did a term at Grenoble University. And I went on university parties and I had skied very little at that time, although, of course, I thought I was wonderful. But I'd done enough to be able to work on it. So that was fine. And then my husband died in 1998. And after that, I thought I might. I'd always said when I was old I would travel full time. So I took up the rest of it. Global travel, adventure, riding, just going to places where not many people go.
Riding. When did you actually start riding?
When I was two, we had a pony called the Nipper, a Shetland pony, in the war. And I just rode around. And so I'd always ridden, so it's not something that I find difficult. It comes more naturally than most things. Certainly more naturally than golf, which is another thing I write about. So when I grew up, I used to have horses to event, just one horse rather. I used to drive out from London and ride it and take it to one-day events rather unsuccessfully. But it eventually led to me writing ghosted autobiographies of Mark Todd and Sir Mark Todd and William Fox Bitt, leaders in the three-day eventing world.
And what was your first riding trip?
The first one actually was in Georgia. We went skiing in Georgia and I met this man who sold cornflakes to Russians. And he and his family went for a riding holiday in the mountains in eastern Georgia, which was amazing. We camped and galloped about the mountains at full speed. Very, very exciting. We met Chechenian rebels and we were given a fusillade from local troops as we rode out in the morning. It was great.
And you had a trip to Ethiopia at one point.
Yes, well, that wasn't riding. It was a press trip. But there I met Johnny Bealby, who founded a company called Wild Frontiers, which was a cutting-edge adventure travel company at that time. He was a proper traveller. He'd written books about riding a motorbike through Africa and horse from Kashgar to the Caspian. You know, he was a real traveller as opposed to a commercial person at that time. And so it was a small niche company and he was bringing his customers into the hotel we were staying in for breakfast. So I met him in the doorway and then I followed it up when I got back. And I got a commission from the Times to go with him to Pakistan, the first trip after it had been closed to travel for about 4 years due to a conflict with India. So we went to the north. It wasn't riding either. We went in jeeps. One thing led to another. So then he offered me a trip for another paper to Kyrgyzstan. And that was when I met Richard Dunwoody. Richard was in the 90s. He was a top steeplechase jockey in the 80s and 90s. And he was champion national hunt jockey 3 years in a row. And he'd ridden the most national hunt winners at that time. And he won the Grand National a couple of times, but he'd had to retire early because he had a potentially paralysing injury to his neck. So he had started leading riding holidays, so he was leading that one, and I went on it, and we always got on very well. So it was the start of a long travel relationship that's taken us to many places around the world, always very enjoyably.
And where in the world did those other riding adventures take you?
Well, the next one I did with him was the one to Tajikistan, which was a three-week trip, I think, was quite long, or 4 weeks we were supposed to go. And it was we ran out of food.
It always adds a certain interest to any trip.
We were supposed to get on and go through to Afghanistan. But we ran out of food, yes, and then demographic for riding holidays is there's eight, probably, middle-aged to older-aged women from England, half of whom can ride and half of whom can't ride at all. So there's always a certain diversity of aspiration and everything. Anyway, we went up into the mountains. We normally had support vehicles, but we abandoned them for this particular stretch. So we went up into the mountains, and the Italian who was co-leading the trip, Dom, he'd surveyed the landscape from the Aga Khan's helicopter in spring when it was all covered in snow. So he thought there'd be alpine pastures underneath, but in fact there were huge boulders. So it was very bad for riding. And we had one tent, which we slept in, or some of them slept outside, but I was not that stupid because it was 4,600 metres and extremely cold. And then we ran out of food. So then Dom, who was a good operator, went off to the local shepherds and said, could you sell us sheep to eat? And they said, yes, of course we could, and we could cook it. So he came back and asked the assembled company if they could have the sheep. And they said, the women all said, oh, no, we couldn't eat a sheep that's alive now. It's up tonight. And so Don went back and ordered half a sheep. And of course, 5 hours later, when it appeared, everybody wanted it. And all the scruples had been suppressed. So we didn't get as much as we'd hoped. We, the carnivorous ones, were a bit cheated on it. So then the next day we trekked on, and eventually we saw the welcome sight of a man standing on a rock holding a bottle of vodka. So they'd found us, and we then managed to descend to the camp and get back together with the support team, which was a great pleasure. Then there was a schism the next day, and everything fell apart, and Dom wanted to keep the troops with him, and Richard wanted to go on to Afghanistan, which was the schedule, and which we'd all got visas and things for. So we had a bit of split up, and half the people stayed with Dom, and Richard and I kidnapped the Belgian couple who wanted to go to Afghanistan, and we went on alone. So that was great, but it was not considered proper behaviour, of course, in the greater scheme of things.
And then self-drive around India?
Yes, Richard and I did that later. That was one of my projects. Self-drive came in. We flew to Calcutta, and then we went up to meet the car and set off for Darjeeling. It is, in fact, turns out to be very difficult to self-drive in India.
Well, survival is. Survival on the roads is quite tricky.
Yes. Well, also, there's trucks with no lights and people on, rickshaws and cycles and pedestrians, and it's just mayhem. But if you want to drive, self-drive in India, there's no better person to be driving than a steeplechase jockey who's used to squeezing large moving items like horses through narrow gaps. So in fact Richard was brilliant at that, and I did a certain amount of driving. And we had another friend, an Australian girl who we'd met in Mongolia on another riding holiday, and she couldn't drive because she'd never driven a car with a stick shift, so didn't seem a place to start, so she didn't drive. But it was very exciting. But when I asked Richard if he'd come on another one for a film, he said certainly not. But I enjoyed it, hey.
And then you're one of the few people who's been to North Korea in recent years.
Yes, that was Richard's project. He said, I'm going to run the marathon in North Korea. Why don't you come? And I said, yeah, why not? I'll come. So we went, we flew to China, and then up to Pyongyang, and the next day he ran in the marathon, and I ran in the 5 kilometre limp, all categories are catered for. And it was like being at the Olympic Games. We were there in the middle of the stadium. Some dignitary came out and made a speech of welcome, I assume. Then we all set off in groups out of the stadium, and then everybody came back later when it had been run. So that was amazing.
So it was an extraordinary experience being in North Korea.
It was extraordinary being in the stadium, which, of course, nobody would come, so it wasn't allowed. So the stadium was filled with soldiers, every seat, who were forced to sit there throughout this procedure. But they did very kindly lay on a football match in the middle for when there weren't any marathon runners coming back. So it was brilliant, really good experience. North Korea, we went for a 10-day trip after that in our bus, with our intensive schedule and our three minders. I mean, you don't, as everybody would know, travel freely in North Korea, and you only see what they want you to see. You have to accept that if you want to go there. But we had excellent food, much the same as in South Korea, plus the dog stew, of course, which was offered. I was unable to eat that, but several of my travel companions did that.
Yuck.
Our trip was brilliant. They were aged 23 to 79, I think, the people on it, from 13 countries, 20 people from 13 countries.
And they were all just tourists, and you were travelling as a tourist.
Well, no, they were all marathon runners. I did write an article about it, but you're not really supposed to do that until afterwards. But the travel company in the end agreed that they would love to have the publicity. Koryo, they're called. They're actually very good if you want to go to North Korea, which I would strongly recommend on interest levels. We went out to the Sea of Japan and then down to the mountains. So it wasn't just Pyongyang and the DMZ, of course.
And on another trip, you went overland from Khartoum to Cairo.
Yes, that was a Wild Frontiers trip, actually, to Sudan. We went out to see the pyramids at Meroe and so on, and camped. And then Richard and I did, for the Financial Times, a journey in the footsteps of Kitchener. And we took the train through the desert up to Wadi Halfa, and then across Lake Nasser in a very leaky ancient boat, which had at one time sunk and drowned all its people, but luckily didn't when we were on it. And then we arrived in Egypt and at Assam and went down in the Nile to Luxor in a boat, stopping at archaeological sites, which was lovely, and then took the train up to the pyramids, to Giza, and then came home. So that was a nice adventure.
And another one you did was to Cuba?
Yes, we did a riding trip to Cuba. We stayed in a beautiful place which had been built in 1955 in the Batista era, just before Castro's. And it was a stud farm. They bred working horses because the Cubans love their horses and they have a lot of those. And they also have a rodeo in Havana, which they bred them for that. So we had lovely horses and we stayed there. They had cockfighting, which was a bit depressing, but of course interesting to see.
Yes, I've seen that in Peru many years ago. Not a pleasant spectacle.
No, it is pretty nasty, that actually. But it's quite interesting to see the locals all betting and screaming and things. And then my passport was stolen, so I got an extra week.
Was it difficult to get another one?
Well, I couldn't get another one in Cuba, and it was just before Easter, so I had to wait till after the holiday before I could even get to see the consul to get a piece of paper to get back into the country. But that was achieved eventually. It was all expensive. I had to buy another flight and so on.
And then you went to Mongolia?
Yes, we went twice to Mongolia, both times with Richard. The first was just quite a tame little circuit of the outside Ulaanbaatar. And then the second time we went up to the reindeer people on the border with Siberia, there's a shaman up there who tells fortunes, a sort of voodoo type of arrangement. So we rode through very sodden forests for some days to get to that, and stayed there, and then we raced across the plains afterwards when we managed to get out to Lake Havskol, which was lovely. So it was quite an adventure, actually, because there's deep bogs everywhere and huge horse flies.
Sounds like a nightmare.
And yeah. Somebody fell off and broke their collarbone in the middle of nowhere. It was desperate to try and get help and morphine, which is what you need in these situations, and was not available to us until the help arrived in the form of a Mongolian woman who couldn't speak a word of English. Anyway, but everybody survived. It was fine in the end. And then we went, that was the year, 2009, the first Mongol Derby. Well, the Mongol Derby was devised by Tom Morgan, who's started a small company called the Adventurists, a niche company. And he started out with the Mongol Rally. He always had an element of charity in his thing, so he's raised over 8 million for charities. The Mongol Rally started in Britain. People had to buy a car costing less than £100 and drive it out as best they could to Ulaanbaatar. And then when they got there was a big party. Tom's a big party man. So that went on for several years, and it was pretty popular, mostly with university students or, you know, not very rich young people with a lust for travel. And then they had to give the Mongolians the cars. However, more recently, the Mongolian lust for ancient cars dwindled, so that no longer happens, I don't think. But Tom then started the Mongol Derby, which was based on Genghis Khan's postal system, which was legendary and actually stretched from the Sea of Japan to the Caspian in the early 1200s. The system was a relay, of course. And in the Mongol Derby, the riders had to ride 40k on one horse to the next Urtu, which is a horse station. Then they could change to another horse. Ones that got there first got the best ones. And that went on for about 10 days, and they rode for 1,000k across the steppe, which was magnificent. Richard started that race. He was supposed to use GPS to find the way, But it was very successful, and it's been oversubscribed ever since, and it's still going on.
And another trip you did was to Patagonia. That was your most recent trip,
yes, I think. Yes, my most recent trip. Very lucky to get it in. Went out in late February and came back in early March, just before lockdown. And this was another adventurist's project. In the meantime, Tom had started a rickshaw run in India, which was a race in rickshaws, as it sounds, and the monkey run in Peru, which was on motorbikes in the mountains in Peru, in the Andes. And so now he wanted to roll out the Derby concept in Patagonia. So he's arranged to stage the Gaucho Derby, which was a very different sort of event. It was only five legs, about 500 kilometres, through the Andes in the southern part of Patagonia, where the weather is generally brutal. So it was based in El Calafate, and then it started 7 hours' drive to the north. It was the first horse race where the riders had to take a pack horse. So they rode into the mountains with a pack horse with huge bags of hay on the sides, so that their two horses would have something to eat while they ploughed through the mountains towards the first horse change spot, which was 80 kilometres away. They always have vet stations to check that the horses are all right, but the medical support was less satisfactory. Because in Mongolia, of course, it's pretty open, so you can get a car up pretty quickly to help anybody. But in the Andes, you can't. So the medical staff had to ride in for 5 hours at least to reach anybody that got injured. So it was all quite hazardous.
So have you ever been injured yourself on any of these trips?
Yes, but only skiing, really, I think.
You had a nasty experience in Ljubljana?
Yes, I had a car crash, actually. I was skiing, but I was driving along the motorway at 11 o'clock in the morning, beautiful sunshine, pulled over to read the map, which was very tricky in Slovenia because of the spelling. So I was parked up on an empty motorway on a hard shoulder, and a man drove into the back of me, Croatian man, and shunted the car straight across the two lanes into the central reservation. So I was lucky that it was an empty motorway. Quite why he did it, I don't know. Anyway, I ended up in the clinic in Ljubljana for 9 days. They didn't know much English there. So there was a nurse, a rather brisk nurse, who was immune to other people's pain. And she didn't know much English. And what she did know was three words, "You may die." She seemed to enjoy saying that.
And you obviously didn't, and came back and made a full recovery from that.
Yes, I did. I had three more weeks and an operation in the Brompton before I could start doing that. Two collapsed lungs.
So indeed, you may die was quite a serious statement. Yes.
Yes, it was, I think, possible at one stage, yes. No, I think she meant it, and she possibly hoped it was true.
But since then, what do you do to keep fit for all these trips?
Well, 40 years ago, I interviewed John Cleese, and I was writing about movies, obviously, and he said, "You should take up Pilates." And I said, "What?" Having never heard of Pilates. And he said what it was. And then I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, you've got a long back like me, so you're sure to have back problems." And I said, "Well, I don't have back problems." So 40 years later, I still don't have back problems, but I have taken up Pilates just before COVID struck. I'm now much fitter than I was, as are many people, I think. We have a teacher called Beverly Skull, who's excellent. So now she does Zoom classes, so I've been doing that because we're all thrown onto our own resources to do things like that. So I've done a lot of cycling, and now, of course, I'm back on the golf course, so I can walk around, and that's quite fitting. Take the dogs for a walk. Not very keen on walking without dogs, I have to say. Not a great hiker, unlike the rest of the planet. Skiing this year before lockdown, so I'm reasonably fit.
And then golf has been an important part of your life.
Yes, I've been lucky with golf. I have possibly the least talent for golf of almost anybody I've ever met. But it's been very good to me. I made a lot of press trips for golf. It's good fun. Quite different to riding because all the people on golf press trips are men. And they talk about football and drink beer, but I have no problem doing that. They don't mind. I don't think they mind having me along. They're probably, certainly not for the football and the beer. They might rather not have me on the golf course.
So that's taken you all over the world?
Yes. I've played golf in, I think, well over 50 countries, including Pakistan and New Zealand and Peru and lots of places. If there's ever a gap and I'm near a golf course, I go and play on it.
And how about the future? Do you have anything in the pipeline?
Well, COVID's really brought the future to a halt as far as travel's concerned, because we don't know what will be possible when. My husband was involved in a charity in Vietnam, so there are plans to go to central Vietnam next year to raise money for the Montagnard people, who are disadvantaged citizens of Vietnam. Otherwise, I don't know.
But after this 3 months of lockdown, you're raring to go. Are you still want to keep travelling?
Well, I would like to, but one has to find the right project and someone to support it, which is increasingly difficult as the travel industry struggles with things which it has no means of coping with, because it has no knowledge of what can happen. So it's difficult times, and I think the travel industry is already under some pressure, and now it can only be intensified.
Your first serious travel adventure was after university, going to South America, was it?
Well, there were 3 years in between when I worked in London as a sold advertising space, and I had a job on 19 magazine, beginning of my fledgling journalistic career. And then one winter's day when I was in the office doing nothing, as usual, I thought, well, there must be better things to do with your life than this. I took a year out and went to America. I started in North America on a Greyhound bus, and then travelled by train down to Mexico, and then spent 3 months there travelling around, and then I flew to Colombia, and I met a Frenchman who was planning to hitchhike through the Andes, and he wanted someone to speak Spanish to interpret for him, and so we travelled together. That was very so. He taught me to hitchhike. And in those days, it wasn't very difficult, actually, in Colombia, because you just walked out of the place you were staying to the edge of the town, and there would be a police post with armed men, and they would stop the next lorry or truck and say, where are you going? And if it was where we wanted to go, they would wave the weapon at the driver and say, well, these people would like to go with you. So it was sort of non-negotiable.
Yes, I remember that.
Very well.
Much the same period. I also hitchhiked through South America.
Yeah.
And I had all sorts of adventures like that. Yes, the help of the local police or military was always invaluable.
Yes, as they were all military dictatorships then, so you could really go where they were very, very nice. They often had beer to offer us. The Frenchman, Guy, he was called, Guy, he knew how to travel for free. He'd just come from the Paris riots in 68. He was a sort of revolutionary type of person coming to do good in South America. And he had learned that you could. So I was supposed to ask in my rudimentary Spanish if we could stay in schools and barracks. So we stayed in a barracks in Quito where there was like a dormitory with about 60 soldiers and him and me and that sort of thing. So we got very good at that, actually. And then in the end, he went off to Northeast Brazil, to Recife, to help Dom Helder Câmara, who was a revolutionary bishop. And I went on down to Chile, hitchhiking by then, from Bolivia, this one. And eventually I got down to Ushuaia, and then down the Amazon. So that was a solo, most of it solo travel. So that was what really taught me to travel, that you should feel at home anywhere, is the key to it, I think. You shouldn't worry.
Any key tips for travellers?
Well, that's the main one. Don't worry. Just if you're in a situation where it's not working out, just wait and see if it does. I mean, if you travel neurotically worrying when the next bus is coming, you are going to be anxious all the time, and then it's no fun. You have to let it take you where it will.
Minty Clinch, thank you very much for coming on the show, and we wish you the very best with your future travels.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.